Hello, listeners, and a very happy nearly new year to you all from Ben and myself. It's nearly 2020. It's nearly a new decade. Thank God we can hopefully shake off the decay that has befallen us over the course of the 2010s. But hey, there were some good bits of the 2010s, not least some of the bits you're about to listen to. We have assembled a clip show. Ben and I have been going back over the last year's recordings of Worst Foot Forward, and we've dug out some of our favourite bits from 2019 with some of our favourite guests. And we've had to leave so many bits out because we've had such a fantastic time the past year or so. Please forgive us if your favourite bits aren't there. Hopefully this will give you some fond memories to look back at. And if you're a new listener to the podcast, hopefully listening to this will encourage you to go and listen to these episodes in full, and indeed our entire archive. You can do that at worstfootforwardpodcast.com, or you can follow us on social media on Twitter on @worstfoot, or find us indeed on Facebook if you look up Worst Foot Forward. We also have our very first live recording of the show coming up in 2020 on February 29th at 4:30 p.m. as part of the Vault Festival in Waterloo in London. Tickets are available now. If you go to vaultfestival.com and look up Worst Foot Forward, then you'll be able to get some tickets to see us do all of this nonsense in person with some special guests. Maybe some of them appear in these very clips you're about to listen to. And speaking of, here are the names of those people who do feature on this little compilation episode. We have, in order of appearance, Dan Muggleton, Ari Eldjarn, Sarah Pettit, Johnny Chiodini, Steve Gribben, Jacob Hawley, Andrew Somerville, Andrew Gruen and Tom Hall, Alistair Beckett-King, Callie Beaton, Rob Mulholland, Suze Kempner, Katie Pritchard, Angus Duneken and Keir Shields, and Alexander Bennett. And we'll be discussing such weird and wonderful things as the musical funded by the island of Nauru, the man who dressed up as a kangaroo to escape from prison, a train for dead people, a sperm bank for Nobel Prize winners, and, of course, quite a lot of toad sex. God, what are we doing in our lives? All right, see you in 2020.
First of all, I went to look for the smallest prison in the world, yes, which Barry found as well. So there is a Channel Island called Sark, S-A-R-K, and it looks like a splodge of paint in the sea. It's a great shape.
Yeah.
You can see it from above, and it's all like little crisscross fields.
And to be clear, it's just 2 square miles.
Yeah, it's tiny.
2 square miles?
Yeah.
Wow.
It has a population of about 500 people.
Correct.
It's like an Australian backyard.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, but also that is the population that spread over about 300 square miles in Australia.
Sure.
It's got a...
But we're full, please don't come.
Yeah. It's got a fascinating history because it basically, throughout history, keeps getting exchanged between the British and the French and the British and the French and the British and the French. And then the Nazis turned up in World War II and went, "Oh, we'll have it." And it was one of those sort of collaborating islands. It's also considered to be the last feudal state in Europe.
Oh, yeah, it's still on Norman law.
Up until 2006, it was a feudal state.
Oh, yeah.
And then eventually, universal suffrage and democracy were introduced.
You're only allowed tractors and horse-drawn vehicles on the road in Sark. There's no cars allowed. And in 2011, Sark was designated as a dark sky community. It's like where there's not that much man-made light, so the sky above it is really, really starry.
Yeah.
So that basically means, so what I'd really love is if you had like, what's the place where astronomers live called? An observatory.
Yes.
If you had like, you've got...
I don't think they live in them. Astronomers live.
They live in an observatory, like the Beatles in Help.
The boom with a telescope inside it.
Yeah.
You think astronomers are like the lighthouse guy?
Yeah, exactly.
Like every night they come out, they're like, oh, hey.
Yeah, just if any UFOs get too close to the planet and then they sort of like let a light round.
Yeah, that's funny.
The prison was built in 1856 and it's this tiny little barrel-roofed prison with two cells, just in case.
Two cells?
Yeah.
Wow, how many per cell? What do we got?
Well, one is 6 foot by 6 foot and the other is 6 by 8, so I'd hope it's just one.
Yeah, but going on some of the other prisons we'd looked at, could be more.
Yeah.
That sounds like every hotel I've stayed in.
Yeah, the prison is now sponsored by EasyJet.
Yeah.
Well, you tell me, Dan, when do you think the last serious crime took place in Sark?
The last serious crime?
Yeah.
Apart from granting women the vote? Yeah.
Collaborating with the Nazis.
Yeah, okay, so between those two...
Oh man, I love it. This is why people shouldn't compliment me. last serious crime. They're unpaid policemen, so you've got to say it's been like at least a lifetime. So what, like 1956?
Oh, you've gone a bit far back in time. That's 1990.
But 1990.
It's still 30 years.
Yeah, it's a brilliant crime.
All right,
it's
sure.
It's a crime that fits exactly on this show. So in 1990, an unemployed French nuclear physicist... The worst kind of nuclear physicist, I think we can all agree.
And let's be clear, he mustn't have been that good, because in 1990, the French were massive into nukes at
they
the time.
Were.
So he must have been the only unemployed French nuclear physicist.
Well, I don't really like a nuclear physicist who goes, what I do, it is art.
I do not love it anymore, I smash my reactor!
Yeah. The champignon cloud.
Lighting up a Gauloise. Yeah. Like, in the core.
A chap called André Gardes. He launched a one-man invasion of the island,
nice.
Claiming to be the rightful lord of Sark. He rode across the island armed with a semi-automatic weapon, and then put up two posters explaining his intentions.
He's doing a fringe shirt.
Yeah. Well, that's how we get people into our venue.
Wow.
Free shirt.
Yeah.
What's the population of the island?
500.
Okay. I like his chances.
Yeah. Well, clearly he must have forgotten to take the safety catch or must have left the safety catch on his automatic weapon because he was stopped when the constable caught up with him, punched him on the nose and arrested him.
Nice.
So it was quite a damp squib in the end what happened. And then since then, the only people who've occasionally been locked up are the odd occasional drunk or an inebriated tourist.
I thought that was just another, you know, French military defeat there.
Yeah.
A real little one, yeah.
Yeah, he'd been reading from the Wile E. Coyote strategy guide.
I think that sounds like one of those who would win in a fight, like a polar bear or a moose.
Yeah,
and you go, who would win in a fight? One French nuclear physicist armed with a semi-automatic, or the entire population of Sark?
Sark, one French nuclear physicist, nil.
Civil Service, I mentioned, they, along with Blackheath Football Club, are one of two clubs to be both founder members of the Football Association and the Rugby Football Union.
Great.
Yeah, that's a good interesting thing, isn't it? And at the FA's founding meeting, the Civil Service were represented by a guy called Mr. Warren from the War Office. So they then became identified as the War Office Club for a long time, which is great. Intimidating. And they took part in the first ever football match at Buckingham Palace in 2013 to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the FA. They played against Polytechnic FC, which was set up in 1875. They lost 2-1. And at half-time, Buckingham Palace footmen and women in waistcoats and tailcoats served water, chocolate bars and orange slices on silver platters to the teams.
I mean, that's how all Americans think all football matches take place over here.
It was
more orange, sir.
Yeah. They had Wembley groundskeepers lay out the pitch in Buckingham Palace. Howard Webb, the Premier and World Cup referee, refereed the match. And Prince William, before the match, warned the teams that if they broke one of his granny's windows, they'd have to answer to her.
Solid. I mean, as a staunch Republican, that makes me like Prince William even more. I do hope that Howard Webb was refereeing the match in kind of like a white three-piece suit with a cravat and a pipe.
Instead of like a pocket watch, he had like a grandfather clock.
Yeah. Let me tell you about Robert Clark Graham, who I love. He made his billions by being an optometrist who invented shatterproof glasses.
Did he invent those shatterproof rulers as well that you used to get in school?
I don't know, but they were very difficult to see through, so I imagine not. But in the latter part of his life, he devoted himself to a project he called the Repository for Germinal Choice. Any ideas what it might do? The Repository for Germinal Choice?
Well, it sounds like a sperm bank to me.
Yeah.
Got it in one, Sarah. Yeah. But not just any old sperm bank.
Is it an Aryan sperm bank?
It wasn't close, but no.
We're going for eugenics here?
Not, well, sort of, but it's a sperm bank using only donations by Nobel Prize winners. However...
The flaw in his plan was that most Nobel Prize winners, by the time they win the Nobel Prize,
are really very elderly
indeed. So it's basically a sperm bank full of dust.
Was he collecting eggs as well?
Very much not. So it was named the Herman J. Muller Repository after a Nobel laureate, and it operated out of Escondido, California from 1980 to 1999. It did also accept donations from non-Nobel Prize winners after, you know, the vaults were a little bit empty, after most Nobel Prize winners went, no, that's mental.
Here's your medal, here's your 750,000 krona, please wank into this mug. The King of Sweden's still here. It's fine. It's part of the ceremony.
The only gentleman who contributed to the bank was...
there was only one in 19 years.
Yeah.
That was a really long wank.
Yeah. Well, he was an American physicist, so he did a quantum wank where he didn't know whether he had come or not. That's probably once you sort of like close the door into the wanking room, you turn into Schrodinger's wanking physicist.
Johnny, we always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What's that for you?
Leapfrog.
So, in which position?
The jumping specifically.
Okay.
Oh, I'm absolutely top at the
crouching.
You're a solid base.
Yeah.
Frog, great at. Leapfrog, not so much.
The thing is, like, I'm 5'8" and I've got quite short legs. Although this really supposed to crouch at a height that's appropriate for you. But anyway, my concern is, like, I'm so worried about getting the height that I don't try and go far enough.
Oh, right.
So I appear to be that jerk who, like, lifts himself up and comes crashing down on someone's back. And there was one time I was doing like an immersive acting gig once, and there was a dance routine involved in which I had to leapfrog over the woman I was dancing with, and I was really nervous about it, and I was like, oh, I'm really, really not sure about this. And a friend of mine, for the purposes of this story, we'll call him Josh Morrill, because that's his name. He was like, come with me, you can leapfrog me a bunch of times, you won't hurt me, like, we'll get your confidence up. And I was like, okay, great. And I really sort of jazzed myself up, and I was like, I'm going to do this. And I legged it, and started to jump. And just as I started to jump, he deliberately stood up.
Oh, no.
So my left thigh sort of glanced off his back, and I basically like, it was like I was skateboarding. I ground along him like he was a rail, and I came crashing
sparks
to the ground.
Coming off his back.
Exactly. And I just hit the deck and winded myself and was like, I'm never going to try this again. So that was the end of my leapfrogging
career.
That
is maybe the most Josh Morrill thing I think I've ever heard of.
Yeah, he was laughing like a drain, as you can imagine.
This is a train line that ran from 1854 to 1941.
I know this.
Ah,
right. I was in a show about this.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, let's see if Steve can guess what it is. There was a single train ran out of London and back. It left a dedicated station near Waterloo, built specifically for the line and its passengers.
Yes, I know what it is.
23-mile journey.
It's the Necropolis, isn't it?
This is the London Necropolis Railway.
It's an amazing story, isn't it?
Yeah.
They took part in the funeral of Gandhi, didn't they? Sorry, Gandhi attended the funeral of somebody in the 1920s.
Yeah, an MP called Charles Bradlaugh in 1891, actually.
That's right, 1891, yeah.
Because he was an MP who was big into Indian self-determination, so he was very popular.
So Gandhi travelled on that line. Incredible.
That's a brilliant bit of trivia.
Tell the listeners about it. It's so good.
So it was created because, so mid-19th century, as population started to explode, London had the problem that there just wasn't enough room in the cemeteries for the bodies. And this is when the Seven Garden cemeteries in London popped up. So places like Highgate and West Norwood, there's one in Stoke Newington.
Kensal Green is there as well.
Yep, you're right. And like people were genuinely afraid that they were gonna have to dig up bodies and cremate them.
Yeah, because I think the population of London had doubled in the first half of the 19th century or something. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was that they would have a cemetery. It's Brookwood Cemetery near Woking in Surrey, about 40 minutes outside of London, and you would board a train with the body. The train with the living and dead passengers would travel out there.
There were
different terminuses depending on whether you were Church of England, Nonconformist, Jewish,
Parsi. They also did have different platforms, so they didn't have, the other passengers didn't have to see the dead Yeah. At Waterloo, there's a separate platform. So they didn't have to come across the site of death because the Victorians were, you know.
Yeah, well, there was York Street, it was called. There was two different ones. There was one in the 19th century called York Street and another on Westminster Bridge, right. Or Westminster Bridge Road. Yeah.
Yes. Which that building's still there.
Yeah, I saw a picture of it. And I really recognise it. And you also had, there was obviously provisions to look after the corpses at Waterloo, and I think also to dress them and get them all ready.
Yeah, you could buy a whole funeral service.
So yeah. You would leave with your dearly departed at 11:40 a.m. You could have a funeral party at one of the cemetery's two train stations, complete with home cooked ham sandwiches and fairy cakes, and then take the same train back to London at 3:30.
Yeah, that's right. They sold return tickets, obviously, to the mourners and one way to the
dead. Oh, Barry,
that's true. You know the ticket prices.
Yes, I saw them.
It's great.
They actually charge the dead.
Oh yeah, they charge the dead more than the living.
That's very funny.
The ticket prices were £6 for return first class, which is 25 quid in today's terms. That's not bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
£2 or £8 now in third class, and the dead. No, it says here the dead cost £1 in first class.
Yeah,
or £2 and
sixpence. That's a single. So it's £6 first class return for the living, £1 one way for the dead.
God, that's such a good point.
Yeah.
And obviously at the time the Bishop of London was not impressed. He said, "I consider it improper. At present, we are not sufficiently habituated to that mode of travelling not to consider the hurry and bustle connected with it as inconsistent with solemnity of a Christian funeral."
Yeah.
And I think the government went, "Yeah, but there's dead people everywhere. Yeah. Shut up, Bish."
Ironically, the Southern Rail could go at the right speed.
Yeah. They did buy their own carriages for the dead bodies because people were felt awkward. I think they rented.
So what did they do? They rented.
Most of the rolling stock for the passengers. But then there was a thing that people would have been squeamish about sharing a carriage which had a dead body in it. So they bought, I think, 6 dedicated carriages for the actual coffins and the corpses.
God.
But they painted them the same livery as whatever trains that they were renting.
Black.
Yeah, black.
Here's a clue.
It's amazing story, isn't it?
It
really is. And so there's another quote I find from Railway Magazine that said, "It's possibly this is the most peaceful railway station in the three corners of the kingdom." This station of the dead.
Yeah, that's right. And then it was hit by a bomb, I think, in the war, and that they sort of, and it had fallen into disuse at that point. I think there was only they were only running it as sort of as needed by then, rather than
I mean, that reminds me of it. It's an old joke. If it got hit by a bomb during the war, a news report said there were 3,000 bodies at the scene. We are talking about the world's worst narcotics. And I thought I would cast the net wide so it can include things that are both legal and illegal.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I would argue when it comes to drugs policy, the law is currently an ass. And it is an ass that is stuffed full of bags of cocaine.
And that's a mule rather than an ass.
Yes, it is.
Very good. Very good.
That's our podcast.
So, Barry, what are some of the world's worst narcotics you've found?
I'm going to bring the voice of inexperience to the subject. I went back and, of course, I looked at the etymology of the word narcotic. From the ancient Greek narco, meaning to make numb. And so it was mainly to do with psychoactive drugs with sleep-inducing properties, so like narcolepsy, same sort of thing. And Galen, the ancient physician, listed things like the mandrake root and poppy seeds, opium, as the main examples of those. Then I was like, oh, mandrake root, that's in like Harry Potter. That's a thing that we've all heard of. It's been used to treat melancholy, convulsions, and mania. However, when taken in large doses, it's also said to excite delirium and madness. So it's sort of like counterproductive. In one superstition, if you pulled the root out, you'd be condemned to hell and you'd die. So it would scream and cry as it was pulled out of the ground and would kill you if you heard it, which is in the Harry Potter movie. So in the past, people used to tie the root of the mandrake to the animals that they were farming with and then get the animals to pour the root out for them. So for example, Josephus, who was a writer in Jerusalem in the 1st century AD, he wrote this: "A furrow must be dug around the root until its lower part is exposed. Then a dog is tied to it. After which the person tying the dog must get away. The dog then endeavours to follow him and so easily pulls up the root, but dies suddenly instead of his master."
This sounds like a curse.
Yeah. There's nothing we love more in this show than, you know, finding ways to kill dogs and interesting. Happens every single fucking episode.
gentleman called Randy Olson. He was like, come on.
You've got to say the word Randy, Ben. I'm going to laugh. This is how the algorithm works.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Olson, a doctoral student at Michigan State University's High Performance Computer Center, he wanted to create an algorithm to solve an eternal problem. He wanted to see if you could develop an algorithm to help you better answer the question of where is Wally?
That is so good. What university's money was he wasting, did you say?
Michigan.
Is he trying to figure out where Wally is or where Waldo is?
For him, it's where Waldo is.
I was wondering, was he like a foreign researcher who'd come to you?
No.
Can he tell the difference between Waldo and Wally?
I mean, he can, but the algorithm, absolutely not. So he found that there was a 53% chance that Wally is located in one of two 1.5-inch horizontal bands which stretch across each spread. So what he did, first of all, he mapped out all of Wally's positions across all 68 of the books published since 1987. And through a statistical process that measures probability, he learned that there's some places that Wally almost never turns up. It's sort of like the opposite of a jigsaw. He's never in the top left or the bottom right.
Nobody puts Wally in a corner.
And then he applied an algorithm that tested all the very possible patterns that you could look at a page at. Mm. And what they do is the algorithm learned as it went along and it would alter its pattern of looking based on the previous pattern. And so eventually he managed to create a path that it was the shortest possible path one would take to follow on the page to find where Wally is. And basically it's sort of like a giant curling snake that curls back on itself. Right. But, and look away now if you don't want to hear the answers, listeners, but if you start in the bottom left corner and sort of curl around in a horseshoe shape up into the middle, then that is the best way to start. I'm not going to tell you any more of the algorithm because I don't want to ruin your Wally finding fun.
Ben's the sort of person who goes through Where's Wally books and actually, with a Sharpie, circles Wally.
And then puts C minus, see me after, at the bottom of the one.
My favourite escape came from a guy named George Billy Hunt. And
we're going on a Billy Hunt. He's escaped again.
We got Australia. What do you think of when you think of Australia?
It's dangerous animals.
Yes, but maybe a kind of annoying one.
Kangaroos.
George Billy the Hunt decided, this was in the early 1800s, to disguise himself.
No fucking way!
As a kangaroo!
Yes!
And then smuggle other prisoners out in his pouch.
I don't know where he got the pelt.
That's so good!
He dressed himself, he began to hop along, and it was actually working. That's the thing that kind of boggles my mind.
Oh my
as
god.
Well, it was working, except that the prison guards who were on watch were, their rations were really short.
Oh no.
And they're sitting there, they're bored, and we all know when you're bored you get hungry.
Yeah.
And they see this lumbering, hopping kangaroo across the plains, and they think, that could be a nice mid-afternoon snack. So they start to take aim, and eventually start firing off a few shots with the guy.
That's so good.
At which point, poor Billy Hunt, you know, he has no choice but to throw off his kangaroo.
Stop shooting me. I'm a prisoner.
And confess to being a human. To which he was rewarded with 120 lashes.
That's so good.
And
well, you've got to tenderize him first before you eat him.
Exactly. So, Billy Hunt, that's my.
I love him.
A kangaroo.
So good.
That's incredible.
Enough people try to escape from prison dressed as gorillas these days.
It is beautiful that his approach to a prison escape is going, I'm going to go for a classic joke format.
That's amazing.
I love that. I mean, I'm sorry to say this about a fellow human being, but he is a prisoner. I'm sort of sad that he didn't get shot.
Yeah. I'm sad he didn't escape and then be adopted by a herd of kangaroo.
Yeah, I'm sad that he didn't escape and then find a little boy trapped down a well and then have to try and communicate that still in character.
Go on to start his own Smith sitcom.
Talking of weird patron saints of things, St. Giles.
Yes.
St. Giles is the patron saint of Edinburgh, but also he lived as a hermit in the south of France in the 7th century, subsisting only on the milk of a female deer,
which I've got to say is impressive.
Was it always the same deer? Or was it a female deer? Or was there one female deer who was really, really draining?
That, gosh, I don't know. I mean, both are equally disturbing.
Yeah, because how's he getting the...
I don't know which is better or worse, to be honest. Like, keeping it in the family. family's a deer. Do you think that he was just, like, knew where the deer was going to graze every day and he would just lie down on the ground knowing that the deer would step over him and then he could just sort of lift it? Incredible core strength.
In disguise.
And just latch on.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's, you know, speaking as a father watching my wife breastfeed, it's tricky to get the latch. So the first few times that he was trying to...
But even more so with a quadruped, I assume. Yeah. I mean, I'm a vegan, so it's not really my area.
Do you think he did it up close, or did he have, like, a long straw, and we just have to, like, on some sort of winch, and just get it lower, and then extend it up, and try and, poop, onto the end of the teat? Is that the noise of a straw touching deer teat? Poop. Yeah. Do you think that he was dressed in his episcopal regalia?
Or as a deer baby?
Yeah.
As a fawn?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I do like what he's the patron saint of now.
He's the patron saint of breastfeeding.
Oh, right.
Which seems very appropriate for a religion that has basically sidelined women for the guts of two millennia.
Yeah, exactly. And the patron saint of breastfeeding in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
You've got to wonder what he is. I mean, to be fair, as two comedians, like being the patron saint of two things that involve sucking someone dry, that feels very on point.
I've just noticed in your notes it says the milk of a female deer, which is a worthwhile note.
Very thanks different patron saint.
Yeah. What's the saint who sucked off a stag for Fosshead for 10 years? What's he the saint of?
This is a very name droppy story. Yeah, are you ready for me to clunk a name?
Hang on, I'll get down on the floor ready to catch.
Please do. So I got to know quite a lot of on screen talent through my time because Viacom owns Comedy Central, among other things. So my favourite bit of that job was that I sat on the Comedy Central development board. So I saw all the cool stuff before it got funded or made. And so we would take sort of on-screen talent to Cannes and to other places around the world just to get investment in shows.
Yeah.
And I got to know the late, great Joan Rivers. Yes.
Holy shit, that is a bigger name.
Sorry, my Max Ben can sit down here with me. I can't hold it.
It gets worse. So I would introduce her at sort of business events where there would be kind of pissed executives, as in the English definition of piss, not angry but drunk, and they would be waiting, and Joan Rivers would do like a quick bit of stand-up that would be tailored to the kind of event or the place, and then I would be basically trying to get people to invest in her show. And I did a few things with her, and the last time I saw her was about 6 months before she died, and we had dinner together. Sorry, this is very
dangerous. No, this is incredible.
And she said to me, mainly the reason I think she liked me was because her lesbian PA, Jocelyn, really liked me. I think Joan was like, I'll do anything for Jocelyn. So Jocelyn very much kept the Joan show on the road. Anyway, and Joan said to me, you know, Callie, think of what you're really doing when you intro me is kind of like warm-up. It's like stand-up. Why don't you do stand-up? And I said, Joan, I'm 45, I've got two kids, I've got a massive day job, the ship has sailed. And she said, Callie, I'm 81. You're going to look back at yourself now and know you were in the thick of it and think, why didn't you? And honestly, that was the conversation that changed my life, because you do sort of think that, and I'm sure lots of your listeners are probably younger than that, and you do kind of think that your path is set, or that if you're 45, maybe I'll go and retrain and be an aromatherapist, or I'll sort of downsize. But to do something where you swap kind of status and security, and everyone wants you at their shows, to being literally nobody and having to sort of bang on the doors of the parties where you were on the guest list. I mean, it really is a complete switch, and I found it so refreshing to walk into rooms and no one knew what I'd done before. I never said it, not least because I didn't want people pitching me their shows for Comedy Central. So for a long time I did both, and it was so refreshing to know that I'm just taking on my own merits, and being a mum, being somebody in the media just doesn't matter. And I know it sounds weird because people fight for status and recognition, but I really loved it. Was like decluttering, getting into a world where that didn't matter. So amazing. Yeah, getting paid in beer tokens instead of corporate shares. Such a smart move.
But I'm going to give you my choice for the Rosewood musical, which is Leonardo the Musical: A Portrait of Love.
Right, a portrait of love. I'm assuming this is the painter, not the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
Yes, yeah, it is very much the painter.
That's a musical that needs to happen.
Oh. I've already got one banging number.
Yeah.
Leonardo the Musical was a musical about a torrid love affair between Leonardo da Vinci and La Gioconda, aka the Mona Lisa. The storyline.
So did this happen? Can we?
No, this didn't happen.
No, the guy who wrote it very much says it draws on creative license.
Right, sure.
He does.
And the worst bit is the lady playing the Mona Lisa. She didn't come out in the West Ham bubble hat and scarf, which is so rude.
It was written by a guy called Duke Minx and Tommy Muller. Now, more of them in a bit. Muller said, I came up with a sort of a plot that might well have been his life. You know, why wouldn't Da Vinci have had an affair with Mona Lisa? It's a bit of a love triangle, really, because she was betrothed to this sort of a bastard, this soldier who didn't treat her very well. That's kind of the plot.
Strong word for plot.
Now, I'll give you a heads up. It closed after 5 weeks with an opening night running time of 4 hours, and most of the audience had left by the time the show finished.
Oh, Jesus, 4 hours is... Yeah, that's too much.
Let's go back to the genesis of it. The guy who was behind it was a guy called Duke Minx. And he
wasn't a jazz saxophonist.
He had been involved in music. He was a roadie for the one-hit wonder pop group Unit 4 Plus 2. Their song Concrete and Clay knocked the Rolling Stones off number one in 1965. And Muller, the guy who wrote with them, had been the lead singer of this band.
Right, Duke... I bet the Stones never got over that.
they've never let it down. Duke Minx had been working during the 80s and 90s as a financial advisor for the nation of Nauru.
And how are the finances of Nauru?
At that time, had been okay. They'd make quite a lot of money from phosphate, essentially harvested from bird droppings.
Right, okay. So it was big in the bird shit business.
Yeah, absolutely. Up to their necks in it.
Yeah, and then moved to the West End to do some dog shit.
Yeah. But by the 1990s, the resources were running out slightly in Nauru, so the government started looking for creative ways to generate new income. And you can see where this is going.
I follow.
Yeah. Minx was talking to this guy, Muller, and they came up with an idea for a musical. They met with the president of Nauru, Bernard Dowie Yogo, played him a few of the songs, and Nauru decided to fund the musical. To the tune of about $7 million.
Literally,
wow. Shit.
It's at this point you have to remember that this is real life and not the plot of a Mel Brooks film.
Yes.
Jesus, I mean, like, the Arts Council funds some absolute shit in this country. Like, they really waste a lot of money on bollocks, but like, surely not $7 million. Although I don't know, to be fair, they might have spent on fucking opera. Sorry, that's another conversation.
It's an important bugbear. I sort of feel like we should, for next December Fringe, we should apply to the government of Nauru and see what we can get away with.
You could start a bidding war, go around like Nauru, Tuvalu, Vanuatu, get them to, you know,
all
up each other.
Top answers.
Yeah. So June 1993, the opening night is coming, and so 100 Nauruan dignitaries, including the president, are due to fly to London for the opening night, and they almost don't make it because people swarm the tarmac at the airport in Nauru trying to stop the plane leaving, protesting at this waste of money that they're involved in. They literally clinged to the airplane to stop it taking off.
Wow.
They eventually managed to take off, police cleared the runway, they flew to the Black Tie premiere, they had a party at the Waldorf Hotel, the reviews were immensely scathing. It's one of the biggest flops in musical theatre history, and as I say, it lost millions, including the $7 million that the Nauruan government had sunk into it within a month. I couldn't even find any recordings of the show,
it's just been shuffled under the carpet.
If you can't even find a bootleg clip of it somewhere on Dailymotion, did it even happen?
And my other favourite story about Freddie Mercury is it was in the late 70s, the Queen were recording in a studio, and in the next studio, the Sex Pistols were recording.
Mm.
And Sid Vicious was kept wandering into their studio under several influences, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Just being a cunt and being kind of homophobic, and they just had to keep ushering him out because they were like, he's quite explosive, and he came in for the last time and went up to Freddie Mercury, sort of jabbed a finger in his face and went, oh yeah, called him a homophobic slur and said, you're trying to bring ballet to the masses, are you? Freddie Mercury got him by the neck against the wall and went, listen, Simon Ferocious. I don't care who you are, fuck off. And you can come back after that.
In America, between 20 and 40,000 people are allergic to semen.
Yeah, that's really exciting.
Yeah, and all of them are homophobic jocks. the allergy, they basically can't have it fired in their eyes.
Oh, I mean, because for the rest of us, that's completely normal.
Yeah.
Imagine if they had that combined with a latex allergy as well, though.
Oh, God.
Because then, like, it makes it even harder.
Yeah. Sorry. So sorry. I thought I was better than that, and I'm not.
No, you're not.
But no, the weird thing is, obviously, most of the time, semen allergies seem to affect women, and they take the form of these small parasitic creatures that live inside them for 9 months and then leave. a woman's downstairs areas can become downstairs
vagina.
Areas for
you can say vagina, it's fine, yeah.
A woman's vagina.
But that is the tone of voice I have to say it in. No one goes, vagina!
It's going
to
be
vagina.
In G-flat again.
Vagina in G-flat.
Vagina. This is next year's podcast award entry. All of us sitting around saying vagina. Vagina, 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 vagina.
Vagina.
No, I correct myself. That's your ringtone, guys.
I'm 34 in 5 days. What's wrong with me?
If the guilty feminist need a new intro music.
Do you guys know who Mario Batali is?
Okay. Yeah, he's a TV chef in America.
Yeah, apparently, TV chef in America, apparently. I apologise to any American listeners. I don't know who your guys are. Sorry. who's Ainsley Harriet? Huh? Answer me that. this wasn't...
Tell you who Ainsley Harriet is. Did you know that as well as being a TV chef, he also played Lister's Gelf Bride in Red Dwarf 6?
Is that Ainsley Harriet?
That is Ainsley Harriet.
And he was a ball boy at Wimbledon in his youth.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
I think it may not have been the bride, it may have been the chief, but
you know what?
Certainly one of the guests.
I'm cancelling the podcast. We're going to host a new game show called Who's Ainsley Harriet?
I like the idea of him just asking if he comes home, he's tired from a day of being Ainsley Harriet, and just haggard, and just looks in the mirror and just, who is Ainsley Harriet?
Okay,
why is Ainsley Harriet?
We need to get Ainsley Harriet on as a guest. If anyone has any connections to Ainsley Harriet or Mario Batali, but we'd rather Ainsley Harriet.
Oh, Ainsley, but he's one of these people with like megawatt charisma. Our recording studio is not big enough to contain one.
You blow all the lamps in the house, like when the kid screams and
he's like, he's like Jean Grey in the X-Men. It's too much power to contain in one human.
Anyway, Mario Batali, I believe that's how you say it, but I just really liked this because it was kind of, packaging apologies with other things. He was one of the guys who got done for a lot of sexual harassment stuff, but it wasn't his
The Me Too stuff.
The Me Too stuff. It wasn't his first time doing the gross and unethical stuff because he'd been accused of being awful in the past because he'd been stealing tips from his employees had been one of the things he'd been accused of doing, which was just pretty bad. But so, yeah, he got some allegations of sexual harassment. And so he had to apologise for it, but he didn't really address them in any meaningful way. He sent out like a newsletter to his subscribers, offering like a sort of half-assed apology, along with a recipe for cinnamon rolls, just there to really sweeten the deal. And I love that logic. I like the idea of the Harvey Weinstein. He's like, yeah, sorry guys, who wants to see a movie? Three movie tickets, popcorn. I know you love popcorn.
Anyone?
So anyway, this Austrian chap, Paul Kammerer, who was a renowned speech impediment, he was experimenting with midwife toads, and the toads, I can feel that you want to make a joke there, so feel free to.
Why do they need midwives?
No. The type of toad was called a midwife toad.
Yeah, I know, but why are they called midwife toads?
Got to look after all the spawn.
Yeah, but the spawn looks after itself, doesn't it?
Oh, well, that's just the sort of irresponsible patriarchal
man's attitude to parents.
Once it's in the spawn, it doesn't need anyone looking after it, right? I can go watch telly.
And this is why we have so many delinquent tadpoles wandering around the ponds of Great Britain. Just, have you ever seen a tadpole with a shiv and some crack? No, because they don't have harness. But the point still stands.
That's very apologies for this, Barry, because I'm about to do a bad Irish accent.
Please, but, by all means.
But when I broke my leg and I was in hospital, I came round for my anaesthetic to see the most sturdy Irish midwife I have ever seen in my entire life. Not that I've seen many, but yeah. She was stood at the foot of my bed and she went, "Hello there, Mr. Bennett. What's going to happen is we're going to take care of you and we're going to make you dinner like your mammy used to make."
You'd broken your leg and you had a midwife there.
Oh yeah, that's a ward system, not a midwife. Yeah.
I'm gonna cut this baby out of you. Yeah. Now we've broken the leg, we'll snap it off completely.
That's the point. She was so stern. If she had said, "We're gonna take this baby out of you," I'd have said, "Yeah, fine." Midwife. This is why I shouldn't get up on Monday mornings.
It's a very silly story.
Midwife. Midwife time. Fiance. Yeah.
And that's how I met my midwife.
Now, as I'm sure you're both aware, most toads mate in water.
Yeah.
But midwife toads.
Sorry, you insinuate that me and Barry fuck toads?
Well, he's clearly got an entire family of tadpoles that he's neglecting.
Yeah, my secret tadpole, my secret toad wife.
Yeah, you're in bed with another toad. The other toad opens the door.
God. Nothing's happening. She pulls open the bedside table, there's a drawer full of spawn. What do you call this? It's only spunk, I promise, it's only spunk.
I can explain.
Yeah, and then they look under your pillows and there's a copy of The Frog Princess. Oh, Barry, how could you?
I thought they would become a prince.
If only.
Well, no,
no, I've been kissing all those ugly men in the hope they turn back into toads.
Well, no, but isn't the tricky thing on toads like one of those species that can change gender?
I mean, anyone can now.
Sorry, let's not go down the path of gender reassignment. Yeah.
Gender's a spectrum, Ben. Come on.
Sorry, sex. They can.
Sex is also a spectrum.
Sex is also a spectrum. No, nevertheless, toads can change their sex.
Yes.
What I'm saying is that's going to be troublesome for Barry if halfway through fucking a toad, it suddenly turns into a lady.
No, no. With toads, I'm bisexual.
Oh, okay.
Strictly humans.
Yeah.
Anyway,
what about these midwife toads, Ben?
So, as you're both aware,
this is the worst adaptation of The Wind in the Willows I've ever seen.
push bah, bah. Why aren't there any mid-husband toads?
I don't know.
When is international mid-husband?
Where's international toad?
There's not. I mean, Barry's motto is: "There's nothing in the world as much fun as messing about in toads." Anyway,
we never get to the end of the
we
story.
We absolutely are.
Our chance is never ending.
As you're both aware, most toads mate in water. Now, Alexander knows this because he is a student of natural history, and Barry knows this because he's a fucking deviant. And when they mate in water, it results in scaly black bumps on their hind limbs, which allow them to hold on to each other during mating, or for randy Irish homosexuals to grab hold on.
Hang on, where do these scaly black bumps come from? Are they allergic to water? It makes the bumps appear? Or are they really into S&M and they have to whack each other's arses to bring up these welts?
No, I think that...
Because that's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you do too much S&M with a toad, then it just explodes.
Yeah. 50 toads of grey.
It's always terrible when your S&M partner explodes. Or brilliant. Depending on what you do.
Have we had a fundamental misunderstanding of what ISIS are up to? That's why they blow themselves up in places like Berlin.
It's just a really elaborate role play.
Yeah.
That's why they're making all of that amateur stuff and uploading it online.
Okay. So, let me get this straight.
ISIS is S&M that got out of hand. It's the greatest.
That's
idea.
The hot take.
Don't wake me off in the van. Oh, no! Oh, well, we'll have to double down on it now, or people know what we've been up to.
Suicide bombing is just wanking. That's their version of wanking. Yeah.
Yeah.
So ISIS fuck toads in water with black welts. That's what we've learned.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they need a midwife on hand to make them food like their mothers make.
That seems to be an excellent summary of what we've got through in the past 5 minutes.
What's just happened in the last 10 minutes? It's all a dream. You were there, and you were there, and you were there.
So, most toads.
Podcast award, please. Podcast award.
Do people in ISIS doing S&M have to bum towards Mecca?
I think we found the line.